Utopia by St. Thomas More, performed by Patrick Horgan. The best state of a commonwealth, the discourse of the extraordinary character Raphael Hithler Deus, as reported by the renowned figure Thomas More, citizen and sheriff of the famous city of Great Britain, London. Book One. The most invincible king of England, Henry VIII of that name, who is distinguished by all the accomplishments of a model monarch, had certain weighty matters recently in dispute with His Serene Highness Charles, Prince of Castile. With a view to their discussion and settlement, he sent me as a commissioner to Flanders, as a companion and associate of the peerless Cuthbert Tunstall, whom he has just created Master of the Rolls, to everyone's immense satisfaction. Of the latter's praises I shall say nothing, not because I fear that the testimony of a friend should be given little credit, but because his integrity and learning are too great for it to be possible, and too well known for it to be necessary, for me to extol them, unless I should wish to give the impression, as the proverb goes, of displaying the sun with a lamp. We were met at Bruges, according to previous arrangement, by those men put in charge of the affair by the prince, all outstanding persons. Their leader and head was the burgomaster of Bruges, a figure of magnificence, but their chief speaker and guiding spirit was Georges de Temsecker, provost of Kassel, a man not only trained in eloquence but a natural orator, most learned too in the law and consummately skilful in diplomacy by native ability as well as by long experience. When, after one or two meetings, there were certain points on which we could not agree sufficiently, they bade farewell to us for some days and left for Brussels to seek an official pronouncement from the prince. Meanwhile, as my business led me, I made my way to Antwerp. While I stayed there, among my other visitors, but of all of them the most welcome was Peter Giles, a native of Antwerp, an honourable man of high position in his hometown, yet worthy of the very highest position, being a young man distinguished equally by learning and character. For he is most virtuous and most cultured, to all most courteous, but to his friends so open-hearted, affectionate, loyal and sincere, that you can hardly find one or two anywhere to compare with him as the perfect friend on every score. His modesty is uncommon. No one is less given to deceit, and none has a wiser simplicity of nature. Besides, in conversation he is so polished and so witty, without offence, that his delightful society and charming discourse largely took away my nostalgia and made me less conscious than before of the separation from my home, wife, and children, to whom I was exceedingly anxious to get back, for I had been then more than 4 months away. One day I had been at divine service in Notre Dame, the finest church in the city, and the most crowded with worshippers. Mass being over, I was about to return to my lodging, when I happened to see him in conversation with a stranger, a man of advanced years with sunburnt countenance and long beard and cloak hanging carelessly from his shoulder, while his appearance and dress seemed to me to be those of a ship's captain. When Peter had espied me, he came up and greeted me. As I tried to return his salutation, he drew me a little aside, and pointing to the man I had seen him talking with, said, "Do you see this fellow? I was on the point of taking him straight to you." "He would have been very welcome," said I, "for your sake." "No," said he, "for his own, if you knew him. There is no mortal alive today who can give you such an account of unknown peoples and lands, a subject about which I know you are always most greedy to hear." "Well, then," said I, "my guess was not a bad one. The moment I saw him, I was sure he was a ship's captain." "But you are quite mistaken," said he, "for his sailing has not been like that of Palinurus, but that of Ulysses, or rather of Plato. Now this Raphael, for such is his personal name, with Hithler Deus as his family name, is no bad Latin scholar and most learned in Greek. He had studied that language more than Latin, because he had devoted himself unreservedly to philosophy, and in that subject he found that there is nothing valuable in Latin except certain treatises of Seneca and Cicero. He left his patrimony at home, he is a Portuguese, to his brothers, and being eager to see the world, joined Amerigo Vespucci, and was his constant companion in the last three of those four voyages which are now universally read of. But on the final voyage he did not return with him. He importuned, and even wrested from Amerigo permission to be one of the 24 who at the farthest point of the last voyage were left behind in the fort. And so he was left behind that he might have his way, being more anxious for travel than about the grave. These two sayings are constantly on his lips. He who has no grave is covered by the sky, and from all places it is the same distance to heaven. This attitude of his, but for the favour of God, would have cost him dear. However, when after Vespucci's departure he had travelled through many countries with 5 companions from the fort, by strange chance he was carried to Ceylon, whence he reached Calicut. There he conveniently found some Portuguese ships, and at length arrived home again beyond all expectation. When Peter had rendered this account, I thanked him for his kindness in taking such pains that I might have a talk with one whose conversation he hoped would give me pleasure. Then I turned to Raphael. After we had greeted each other and exchanged the civilities which commonly pass at the first meeting of strangers, we went off to my house. There, in the garden, on a bench covered with tufts of grass, we sat down to talk together. He recounted how, after the departure of Vespucci, he and his friends who had stayed behind in the fort began by degrees, through continued meetings and civilities, to ingratiate themselves with the natives, till they were not only stood in no danger from them, but were actually on friendly terms, and moreover were in good repute and favour with a ruler whose name and country I have forgotten. Through the latter's generosity, he and his 5 companions were supplied with ample provision and travel resources, and moreover with a trusty guide on their journey, which was partly by water on rafts and partly over land by wagon, to take them to other rulers with careful recommendations to their favour. For after travelling many days, he said, they found towns and cities and very populous commonwealths with excellent institutions. To be sure, under the equator and on both sides of the line, nearly as far as the sun's orbit extends, there lie waste deserts scorched with continual heat. A gloomy and dismal region looms in all directions without cultivation or attractiveness, inhabited by wild beasts and snakes, or indeed men, no less savage and harmful than other beasts. But when you have gone a little farther, the country gradually assumes a milder aspect. The climate is less fierce, the ground is covered with a pleasant green herbage, and the nature of living creatures becomes less wild. At length, you reach peoples, cities, and towns which maintain a continual traffic by sea and land, not only with each other and their neighbours, but also with far-off countries. Then they had opportunity of visiting many countries in all directions, for every ship which was got ready for any voyage made him and his companions welcome as passengers. The ships they saw in the parts first travelled were flat-bottomed and moved under sails made of papyrus or osiers stitched together, and sometimes under sails made of leather. Afterwards they found ships with pointed keels and canvas sails, in fact, like our own in all respects. Their mariners were skilled in adapting themselves to sea and weather, but he reported that he won their extraordinary favour by showing them the use of the magnetic needle, of which they had hitherto been quite ignorant, so that they had hesitated to trust themselves to the sea, and had boldly done so in the summer only. Now, trusting to the magnet, they do not fear wintry weather, being dangerously confident. Thus, there is a risk that what was thought likely to be a great benefit to them may, through their imprudence, cause them great mischief. What he said he saw in each place would be a long tale to unfold, and is not the purpose of this work. Perhaps on another occasion we shall tell his story, particularly whatever facts would be useful to readers, above all those wise and prudent provisions which he noticed anywhere among nations living together in a civilized way. For on these subjects we eagerly inquired of him, and he no less readily discoursed. But about stale travellers' wonders we were not curious. Silas and greedy Silenus, and folk-devouring Laestrigones, and similar frightful monsters are common enough. But well and wisely trained citizens are not everywhere to be found. To be sure, just as he called attention to many ill-advised customs among these new nations, so he rehearsed not a few points from which our own cities, nations, races, and kingdoms may take example for the correction of their errors. These instances, as I said, I must mention on another occasion. Now I intend to relate merely what he told us of the manners and customs of the Utopians, first, however, giving the talk which drew and led him on to mention that commonwealth. Raphael had touched with much wisdom on faults in this hemisphere and that, of which he found very many in both, and had compared the wiser measures which had been taken among us, as well as among them, for he remembered the manners and customs of each nation as if he had lived all his life in places which he had only visited. Peter expressed his surprise at the man as follows. "Why, my dear Raphael, I wonder that you do not attach yourself to some king. I am sure there is none of them to whom you would not be very welcome, because you are capable not only of entertaining a king with this learning and experience of men and places, but also of furnishing him with examples and of assisting him with counsel. Thus you would not only serve your own interests excellently, but be of great assistance in the advancement of all your relatives and friends." "As for relatives and friends," he replied, "I am not greatly troubled about them, for I think I have fairly well performed my duty to them already. The possessions which other men do not resign unless they are old and sick, and even then resign unwillingly when incapable of retention, I divided among my relatives and friends when I was not merely hale and hearty but actually young. I think they ought to be satisfied with this generosity from me, and not to require or expect additionally that I should, for their sakes, enter into servitude to kings." "Fine words," declared Peter. "I meant not that you should be in servitude, but in service to kings." "The one is but one syllable less than the other," he observed. "But my conviction is," continued Peter, "whatever name you give to this mode of life, that it is the very way by which you can not only profit people, both as private individuals and as members of the Commonwealth, but also render your own condition more prosperous." "Should I," said Raphael, "make it more prosperous by a way which my soul abhors? As it is, I now live as I please, which I surely fancy is very seldom the case with your grand courtiers. Nay, there are plenty of persons who court the friendship of the great, and so you need not think it a great loss if they have to do without me and one or two others like me." "Well," I then said, "it is plain that you, my dear Raphael, are desirous neither of riches nor of power. Assuredly, I reverence and look up to a man of your mind no whit less than to any of those who are most high and mighty. But it seems to me you will do what is worthy of you and of this generous and truly philosophic spirit of yours, if you so order your life as to apply your talent and industry to the public interest, even if it involves some personal disadvantages to yourself. This you can never do with as great profit as if you are counsellor to some great monarch, and make him follow, as I am sure you will, straightforward and honourable courses. From the monarch, as from a never-failing spring, flows a stream of all that is good or evil over the whole nation. You possess such complete learning that even had you no great experience of affairs, and such great experience of affairs that even had you no learning, you would make an excellent member of any king's council." "You are twice mistaken, my dear More," said he. "First in me, and then in the matter in question. I have no such ability as you ascribe to me, and if I had ever so much, still, in disturbing my own peace and quiet, I should not promote the public interest. In the first place, almost all monarchs prefer to occupy themselves in the pursuits of war, with which I neither have nor desire any acquaintance, rather than in the honourable activities of peace. And they care much more how, by hook or by crook, they may win fresh kingdoms than how they may administer well what they have got. In the second place, among royal counsellors, everyone is actually so wise as to have no need of profiting by another's counsel, or everyone seems so wise in his own eyes as not to condescend to profit by it, save that they agree with the most absurd sayings of, and play the parasite to, the chief royal favourites, whose friendliness they strive to win by flattery. To be sure, it is but human nature that each man favour his own discoveries most, just as the crow and the monkey like their own offspring best. If anyone, when in the company of people who are jealous of others' discoveries, or prefer their own, should propose something which he either has read of, has done in other times, or has seen done in other places, the listeners behave as if their whole reputation for wisdom were jeopardized, and as if afterwards they would deserve to be thought plain blockheads unless they could lay hold of something to find fault with in the discoveries of others. When all other attempts fail, their last resource is a remark such as this: "Our forefathers were happy with that sort of thing, and would to heaven we had their wisdom." And then, as if that comment were a brilliant conclusion to the whole business, they take their seats, implying, of course, that it would be a dangerous thing to be found with more wisdom on any point than our forefathers. And yet, no matter what excellent ideas our forefathers may have had, we very serenely bid them a curt farewell. But if in any situation they failed to take the wiser course, that defect gives us a handle which we greedily grab and never let go. Such proud, ridiculous, and obstinate prejudices I have encountered often in other places, and once in England too. "What?" I asked. "Were you ever in our country?" "Yes," he answered. "I spent several months there, not long after the disastrous end of the insurrection of Western Englishmen against the king, which was put down with their pitiful slaughter. During that time I was much indebted to the Right Reverend Father John Cardinal Morton, Archbishop of Canterbury, and then also Lord Chancellor of England. He was a man, my dear Peter, for Moore knows about him and needs no information from me, who deserved respect as much for his prudence and virtue as for his authority. He was of middle stature, and showed no sign of his advanced age. His countenance inspired respect rather than fear. In conversation he was agreeable, though serious and dignified. Of those who made suit to him, he enjoyed making trial by rough address, but in a harmless way, to see what mettle and what presence of mind a person would manifest. Provided it did not amount to impudence, such behaviour gave him pleasure as being akin to his own disposition, and excited his admiration as being suited to those holding public office. His speech was polished and pointed. His knowledge of law was profound, his ability incomparable, and his memory astonishingly retentive, for he had improved his extraordinary natural qualities by learning and practice. The king placed the greatest confidence in his advice, and the Commonwealth seemed much to depend upon him when I was there. As one might expect, almost in earliest youth, he had been taken straight from school to court, had spent his whole life in important public affairs, and had sustained numerous and varied vicissitudes of fortune, so that by many and great dangers he had acquired a statesman's sagacity, which, when thus learned, is not easily forgotten. It happened one day that I was at his table, when a layman, learned in the laws of your country, was present. Availing himself of some opportunity or other, he began to speak punctiliously of the strict justice which was then dealt out to thieves. They were everywhere executed, he reported, as many as 20 at a time being hanged on one gallows, and added that he wondered all the more, though so few escaped execution, by what bad luck the whole country was still infested with them. I dared be free in expressing my opinions without reserve at the Cardinal's table, so I said to him, "You need not wonder, for this manner of punishing thieves goes beyond justice and is not for the public good. It is too harsh a penalty for theft, and yet is not a sufficient deterrent. Theft alone is not a grave offence that ought to be punished with death, and no penalty that can be devised is sufficient to restrain from acts of robbery those who have no other means of getting a livelihood. In this respect, not your country alone, but a great part of our world resembles bad schoolmasters, who would rather beat than teach their scholars. You ordain grievous and terrible punishments for a thief, when it would have been much better to provide some means of getting a living, that no one should be under this terrible necessity, first of stealing and then of dying for it." "We have," said the fellow, "made sufficient provision for this situation. There are manual crafts, there is farming. They might maintain themselves by these pursuits if they did not voluntarily prefer to be rascals." "No," I countered, "you shall not escape so easily. We shall say nothing of those who often come home crippled from foreign or civil wars, as recently with you Englishmen from the battle with the Cornishmen and not long ago from a war in France. They lose their limbs in the service of the Commonwealth or the King, and their disability prevents them from exercising their own crafts, and their age from learning a new one. Of these men, I say, we shall take no account, because wars come sporadically, but let us consider what happens every day. Now, there is a great number of noblemen who not only live idle themselves like drones on the labours of others, as, for instance, the tenants of their estates, whom they fleece to the utmost by increasing the returns, for that is the only economy they know of, being otherwise so extravagant as to bring themselves to beggary, but who also carry about with them a huge crowd of idle attendants who have never learned a trade for a livelihood. As soon as their master dies or they themselves fall sick, these men are turned out at once, for the idle are maintained more readily than the sick, and often the heir is not able to support as large a household as his father did, at any rate at first. In the meantime, the fellows devote all their energies to starving, if they do not, to robbing. Indeed, what can they do? When by a wandering life they have worn out their clothes a little and their health to boot, sickly and ragged as they are, no gentleman deigns to engage them, and the farmers dare not do so either. The latter know full well that a man who has been softly brought up in idleness and luxury, and has been wont in sword and buckler to look down with a swaggering face on the whole neighbourhood, and to think himself far above everybody, will hardly be fit to render honest service to a poor man with spade and hoe for a scanty wage, and on frugal fare. But this, the fellow retorted, is just the sort of man we ought to encourage most. On them, being men of a loftier and nobler spirit than craftsmen and farmers, depend the strength and sinews of our army when we have to wage war. Of course, said I, you might as well say that for the sake of war we must foster thieves. As long as you have these men, you will certainly never be without thieves. Nay, robbers do not make the least active soldiers, nor do soldiers make the most listless robbers, so well do these two pursuits agree. But this defect, though frequent with you, is not peculiar to you, for it is common to almost all peoples. France, in particular, is troubled with another more grievous plague. Even in peacetime, if you can call it peacetime, the whole country is crowded and beset with mercenaries, hired because the French follow the train of thought you Englishmen take in judging it a good thing to keep idle retainers. These wiseacres think that the public safety depends on having always in readiness a strong and reliable garrison, chiefly of veterans, for they have not the least confidence in tyros. This attitude obliges them always to be seeking for a pretext for war, just so they may not have soldiers without experience, and men's throats must be cut without cause, lest, to use Sallust's witty saying, the hand or the mind, through lack of practice, become dulled. Yet how dangerous it is to rear such wild beasts, France has learned to its cost. And the examples of Rome, Carthage, Syria, and many other nations show. Not only the supreme authority of the latter countries, but their land and even their cities have been more than once destroyed by their own standing armies. Now, how unnecessary it is to maintain them is clearly proved by this consideration. Not even the French soldiers, assiduously trained in arms from infancy, can boast that they have very often got the better of it face to face with your draftees. Let me say no more, for fear of seeming to flatter you barefacedly. At any rate, your town-bred craftsmen, or your rough and clodhopper farmers, are not supposed to be much afraid of those idle attendants on gentlemen, except those of the former whose build of body is unfitted for strength and bravery, or those whose stalwart spirit is broken by lack of support for their family. Consequently, there is no danger that those attendants, whose bodies, once strong and vigorous, for it is only the picked men that gentlemen deign to corrupt, are now either weakened by idleness or softened by almost womanish occupations, should become unmanned, if trained to earn their living in honest trades, and exercised in virile labours. However the case may be, it seems to me by no means profitable to the common weal to keep, for the emergency of a war, a vast multitude of such people as trouble and disturb the peace. You never have war unless you choose it, and you ought to take far more account of peace than of war. Yet this is not the only situation that makes thieving necessary. There is another, which, as I believe, is more special to you Englishmen. What is that? Asked the cardinal. Your sheep, I answered, which are usually so tame and so cheaply fed, begin now, according to report, to be so greedy and wild that they devour human beings themselves and devastate and depopulate fields, houses, and towns. In all those parts of the realm where the finest and therefore costliest wool is produced, there are noblemen, gentlemen, and even some abbots, though otherwise holy men, who are not satisfied with the annual revenues and profits which their predecessors used to derive from their estates. They are not content by leading an idle and sumptuous life to do no good to their country. They must also do it positive harm. They leave no ground to be tilled. They enclose every bit of land for pasture. They pull down houses and destroy towns, leaving only the church to pen the sheep in. And as if enough of your land were not wasted on ranges and preserves of game, those good fellows turn all human habitations and all cultivated land into a wilderness. Consequently, in order that one insatiable glutton and accursed plague of his native land may join field to field and surround many thousand acres with one fence, tenants are evicted. Some of them, either circumvented by fraud or overwhelmed by violence, are stripped even of their own property, or else, wearied by unjust acts, are driven to sell. By hook or by crook, the poor wretches are compelled to leave their homes. Men and women, husbands and wives, orphans and widows, parents with little children, and a household not rich but numerous, since farm work requires many hands. Away they must go, I say, from the only homes familiar and known to them. And they find no shelter to go to. All their household goods, which would not fetch a great price if they could wait for a purchaser, since they must be thrust out, they sell for a trifle. After they have soon spent that trifle in wandering from place to place, what remains for them but to steal and be hanged, justly, you may say, or to wander and beg? And yet even in the latter case they are cast into prison as vagrants for going about idle, when though they most eagerly offer their labour, there is no one to hire them, for there is no farm work to which they have been trained to be had, when there is no land for ploughing left. A single shepherd or herdsman is sufficient for grazing livestock on that land, for whose cultivation many hands were once required to make it raise crops. A result of this situation is that the price of food has risen steeply in many localities. Indeed, the price of raw wools has climbed so high that your poor people, who used to make cloth, cannot possibly buy them, and so great numbers are driven from work into idleness. One reason is that after the great increase in pasture land, a plague carried off a vast multitude of sheep, as though God were punishing greed by sending upon the sheep a murrain, which should have fallen on the owners' heads more justly. But however much the number of the sheep increases, their price does not decrease a farthing, because though you cannot brand that a monopoly, which is a sale by more than one person, yet their sale is certainly an oligopoly, for all sheep have come into the hands of a few men, and those already rich, who are not obligated to sell before they wish, and who do not wish until they get the price they ask. By this time, all other kinds of livestock are equally high-priced, on the same account, and still more so, for the reason that, with the pulling down of farmsteads and the lessening of farming, none are left to devote themselves to the breeding of stock. These rich men will not rear young cattle as they do lambs, but they buy them lean and cheap abroad, and then, after they are fattened in their pasture, sell them again at a high price. In my estimation, the whole mischief of this system has not yet been felt. Thus far, the dealers raise the prices only where the cattle are sold, but when, for some time, they have been removing them from other localities faster than they can be bred there, then, as the supply gradually diminishes in the markets where they are purchased, great scarcity must needs be here. Thus, the unscrupulous greed of a few is ruining the very thing by virtue of which your island was once counted fortunate in the extreme. for the high price of food is causing everyone to get rid of as many of his household as possible. And what, I ask, have they to do but to beg, or, a course more readily embraced by men of metal, to become robbers? In addition, alongside this wretched need and poverty, you find want and luxury. Not only the servants of noble men, but the craftsmen and almost the clodhoppers themselves, in fact all classes alike, are given to much ostentatious sumptuousness of dress and to excessive indulgence at table. Do not dives, brothels, and those other places as bad as brothels, to wit, taverns, wine shops, and alehouses, do not all those crooked games of chance, dice, cards, backgammon, ball, bowling, and quoits, soon drain the purses of their votaries and send them off to rob someone? Cast out these ruinous plagues. Make laws that the destroyers of farmsteads and country villages should either restore them or hand them over to people who will restore them and who are ready to build. Restrict this right of rich individuals to buy up everything, and this license to exercise a kind of monopoly for themselves. Let fewer be brought up in idleness. Let farming be resumed, and let cloth working be restored once more, that there may be honest jobs to employ usefully that idle throng, whether those whom hitherto pauperism has made thieves, or those who now, being vagrants or lazy servants, in either case are likely to turn out thieves. Assuredly, unless you remedy these evils, it is useless for you to boast of the justice you execute in the punishment of theft. Such justice is more showy than really just or beneficial. When you allow your youths to be badly brought up, and their characters, even from early years, to become more and more corrupt, to be punished, of course, when, as grown-up men, they commit the crimes which, from boyhood, they have shown every prospect of committing, what else, I ask, do you do but first create thieves, and then become the very agents of their punishment? Even while I was saying these things, the lawyer had been busily preparing himself to reply, and had determined to adopt the usual method of disputants, who are more careful to repeat what has been said than to answer it, so highly do they regard their memory. "Certainly, sir," he began. "You have spoken well, considering that you are but a stranger who could hear something of these matters rather than get exact knowledge of them, a statement which I shall make plain in a few words. First, I shall repeat in order what you have said, then I shall show in what respects ignorance of our conditions has deceived you. Finally, I shall demolish and destroy all your arguments. So, to begin with, what I promised first, on 4 points you seemed to me—" "Hold your peace," interrupted the cardinal. "For you hardly seem about to reply in a few words if you begin thus. So we shall relieve you of the trouble of making your answer now, but we shall reserve your right unimpaired till your next meeting, which I should like to set for tomorrow, provided neither you nor Raphael here is hindered by other business. But now I am eager to have you tell me, my dear Raphael, why you think that theft ought not to be punished with the extreme penalty, or what other penalty you yourself would fix, which would be more beneficial to the public. I am sure that not even you think it ought to go unpunished. Even as it is, with death as the penalty, men still rush into stealing. What force and what fear, if they once were sure of their lives, could deter the criminals? They would regard themselves as much invited to crime by the mitigation of the penalty as if a reward were offered." "Certainly," I answered, "most reverend and kind father, I think it altogether unjust that a man should suffer the loss of his life for the loss of someone's money. In my opinion, not all the goods that fortune can bestow on us can be set in the scale against a man's life. If they say that this penalty is attached to the offence against justice and the breaking of the laws, hardly to the money stolen, one may well characterize this extreme justice as extreme wrong. For we ought not to approve such stern, manlian rules of law as would justify the immediate drawing of the sword when they are disobeyed in trifles, nor such stoical ordinances as count all offences equal, so that there is no difference between killing a man and robbing him of a coin, when, if equity has any meaning, there is no similarity or connection between the two cases. God has said, 'Thou shalt not kill.' And shall we so lightly kill a man for taking a bit of small change? But if the divine command against killing be held not to apply where human law justifies killing, what prevents men equally from arranging with one another how far rape, adultery, and perjury are admissible? God has withdrawn from man the right to take not only another's life, but his own. Now men by mutual consent agree on definite cases where they may take the life of one another. But if this agreement among men is to have such force as to exempt their henchmen from the obligation of the commandment, although without any precedent set by God, they take the life of those who have been ordered by human enactment to be put to death, will not the law of God then be valid only so far as the law of man permits? The result will be that in the same way men will determine in everything how far it suits them that God's commandments should be obeyed. Finally, the law of Moses, though severe and harsh, being intended for slaves and those of stubborn breed, nevertheless punished theft by fine and not by death. Let us not suppose that God, in the new law of mercy, in which he gives commands as a father to his sons, has allowed us greater license to be cruel to one another. These are the reasons why I think this punishment unlawful. Besides, surely everyone knows how absurd and even dangerous to the commonwealth it is that a thief and a murderer should receive the same punishment. Since the robber sees that he is in as great danger if merely condemned for theft as if he were convicted of murder as well, this single consideration impels him to murder the man whom otherwise he would only have robbed. In addition to the fact that he is in no greater danger if caught, there is greater safety in putting the man out of the way and greater hope of covering up the crime if he leaves no one left to tell the tale. Thus, while we endeavour to terrify thieves with excessive cruelty, we urge them on to the destruction of honest citizens. As to the repeated question about a more advisable form of punishment, in my judgment it is much easier to find a better than a worse. Why should we doubt that a good way of punishing crimes is the one which we know long found favour of old with the Romans, the greatest experts in managing the commonwealth? When men were convicted of atrocious crimes, they condemned them for life to stone quarries and to digging in metal mines and kept them constantly in chains. Yet, as concerns this matter, I can find no better system in any country than that which, in the course of my travels, I observed in Persia among the people commonly called Polylorites, a nation that is large and well-governed, and except that it pays an annual tribute to the Persian Padishah, otherwise free and autonomous in its laws. They are far from the sea, almost ringed round by mountains, and satisfied with the products of their own land, which is in no way infertile. In consequence, they rarely pay visits to other countries or receive them. In accordance with their long-standing national policy, they do not try to enlarge their territory, and easily protect what they have from all aggression by their mountains and by the tribute paid to their overlord. Being completely free from militarism, they live a life more comfortable than splendid and more happy than renowned or famous, for even their name, I think, is hardly known except to their immediate neighbours. Now, in their land, persons who are convicted of theft repay to the owner what they have taken from him, not, as is usual elsewhere, to the prince, who they consider has as little right to the thing stolen as the thief himself. But if the object is lost, the value is made up out of the thieves' goods, and the balance is then paid intact to their wives and children. They themselves are condemned to hard labour. Unless the theft is outrageous, they neither are confined to prison nor wear shackles about their feet, but without any bonds or restraints are set to public works. Convicts who refuse to labour or are slack are not put in chains, but urged on by the lash. If they do a good day's work, they need fear no insult or injury. The only check is that every night after their names are called over, they are locked in their sleeping quarters. Except for the constant toil, their life has no hardship. For example, as serviceable to the common weal, they are fed well at the public's expense. the mode varying from place to place. In some parts, what is spent on them is raised by almsgiving. Though this method is precarious, the Polylorite people are so kind-hearted that no other is found to supply the need more plentifully. In other parts, fixed public revenues are set aside to defray the cost. Elsewhere, all pay a specified personal tax for these purposes. Yes, and in some localities the convicts do no work for the community, but whenever a private person needs a hired labourer, he secures in the marketplace a convict's service for that day at a fixed wage, a bit lower than what he would have paid for free labour. Moreover, the employer is permitted to chastise with stripes a hired man if he be lazy. The result is that they are never out of work and that each one, besides earning his own living, brings in something every day to the public treasury. All of them wear clothes of a colour not worn by anyone else. Their hair is not shaved, but cropped a little above the ears, from one of which the tip is cut off. Food and drink and clothes of the proper colour may be given them by their friends. The gift of money is a capital offence, both for the donor and the receiver. It is no less dangerous for a free man to receive a penny for any reason from a condemned person, or for slaves, which is the name borne by the convicts, to touch weapons. The slaves of each district are distinguished by a special badge, which it is a capital offence to throw away, as it is to appear beyond their own bounds or to talk to a slave from another district. Further, it is no safer to plot escape than actually to run away. Yes, and the punishment for connivance in such a plan is death for the slave and slavery for the free man. On the other hand, rewards are appointed for an informer, money for a free man, liberty for a slave, and pardon and immunity for both for their complicity. The purpose is never to make it safer to follow out an evil plan than to repent of it. This is the law, and this the procedure in the matter as I have described it to you. You can easily see how humane and advantageous it is. The object of public anger is to destroy the vices, but to save the persons, and so to treat them that they necessarily become good, and that for the rest of their lives they repair all the damage done before. Further, so little is it to be feared that they may sink back into their old evil ways, even travellers who have to go on a journey think themselves most safe if they secure as guides these slaves, who are changed with each new district, for the latter have nothing suitable with which to commit robbery. They bear no arms. Money would merely ensure the detection of the crime, punishment awaits the man who is caught, and there is absolutely no hope of escaping to a safe place. How could a man so cover his flight as to elude observation when he resembles ordinary people in no part of his attire, unless he would have run away naked? Even then his ear would betray him in his flight. But, of course, would there not be at least a risk of their taking counsel together and conspiring against the Commonwealth? As if any district could conceive a hope of success without having first sounded and seduced the slave gangs of many other districts. The latter are so little able to conspire together that they may not even meet and converse or greet one another. Much less will they boldly divulge to their own fellow slaves the plot which they know is dangerous to those concealing it and very profitable to those betraying it. On the other hand, no one is quite without hope of gaining his freedom eventually if he accepts his punishment in a spirit of obedience and resignation and gives evidence of reforming his future life. Indeed, every year a number of them are granted their liberty, which they have merited by their submissive behaviour. When I had finished this speech, I added that I saw no reason why this method might not be adopted even in England and be far more beneficial in its working than the justice which my legal opponent had praised so highly. The lawyer replied, "Never could that system be established in England without involving the Commonwealth in a very serious crisis." In the act of making this statement, he shook his head and made a wry face and so fell silent. And all who were present gave him their assent. Then the cardinal remarked, "It is not easy to guess whether it would turn out well or ill, inasmuch as absolutely no experiment has been made." If after pronouncement of the sentence of death the king were to order the postponement of its execution, and after limitation of the privileges of sanctuary were to try this system, then, if success proved its usefulness, it would be right to make the system law. In case of failure, then and there to put to death those previously condemned would be no less for the public good and no more unjust than if execution were done here and now. In the meantime, no danger can come of the experiment. Furthermore, I am sure that vagrants might very well be treated in the same way, for, in spite of repeated legislation against them, we have made no progress. When the cardinal had finished speaking, they all vied in praising what they all had received with contempt when suggested by me, but especially the part relating to vagrants, because this was the cardinal's addition. I'm at a loss as to whether it were better to suppress what followed next, for it was quite absurd, but I shall relate it, since it was not evil in itself, and had some bearing on the matter in question. There happened to be present a hanger-on who wanted to give the impression of imitating a jester, but whose imitation was too close to the real thing. His ill-timed witticisms were meant to raise a laugh, but he himself was more often the object of laughter than his jests. The fellow, however, sometimes let fall observations which were to the point, thus proving the proverb true that if a man throws the dice often, he will sooner or later make a lucky throw. One of the guests happened to say, "Raphael's proposal has made good provision for thieves. The cardinal has taken precautions also for vagrants. It only remains now that public measures be devised for persons whom sickness or old age has brought to want and made unable to work for their living." "Give me leave," volunteered the hanger-on. "I shall see that this situation too be set right. I'm exceedingly anxious to get this sort of person out of my sight. They have often harassed me with their pitiful whinings and begging for money, though they never could pitch a tune which would get a coin out of my pocket. For one of two things always happens. Either I do not want to give, or I cannot, since I have nothing to give. Now, they have begun to be wise. When they see me pass by, they say nothing and spare their pains. They no longer expect anything from me. No more, by heaven, than if I were a secular priest. As for me, I should have a law passed that all those beggars be distributed and divided among the Benedictine monasteries, and that the men be made so-called lay brothers. The women I should order to become nuns." The cardinal smiled and passed it off in jest, but the rest took it in earnest. Now a certain theologian, who was a friar, was so delighted by this jest at the expense of secular priests and of monks that he also began to make merry, though generally he was serious, almost to the point of being dour. "Nay," said he, "not even so will you be rid of mendicants, unless you make provision for us friars too." "But this has been taken care of already," retorted the hanger-on. "His Eminence made excellent provision for you when he determined that tramps should be confined and made to work, for you are the worst tramps of all." When the company, looking at the cardinal, saw that he did not think this jest any more amiss than the other, they all proceeded to take it up with vigour. But not the friar. He, and I do not wonder, deluged by these taunts, began to be so furious and enraged that he could not hold back even from abusing the joker. He called him a rascal, a slanderer, and a son of perdition, quoting the while terrible denunciations out of Holy Scripture. Now the scoffer began to scoff in earnest, and was quite in his element. "Be not angry, good friar, it is written, 'In your patience shall you possess your souls.'" Then the friar rejoined, I shall repeat his very words, "I am not angry, you gallows bird, or at least I do not sin, for the psalmist says, 'Be angry and sin not.'" At this point the cardinal gently admonished the friar to calm his emotions, but he replied, "No, my lord, I speak motivated only by a good zeal, as I should. For holy men have had a good zeal, wherefore Scripture says, 'The zeal of thy house has eaten me up,' and churches resound with the hymn, 'The mockers of Eliseus, as he went up to the house of God, felt the zeal of the bald head,' just as this mocking, scorning, ribald fellow will perhaps feel it. Maybe, said the cardinal, you behave with proper feeling, but I think that you would act, if not more holily, at any rate more wisely, if you would not set your wits against those of a silly fellow and provoke a foolish duel with a fool. No, my lord, he replied. I should not do more wisely. Solomon himself, the wisest of men, says, answer a fool according to his folly, as I do now. I am showing him the pit into which he will fall if he does not take good heed. For if many scorners of Eliseus, who numbered only one bald head, felt the zeal of the bald head, how much more will one scorner of many friars, among whom are numbered many bald heads? And besides, we have a papal bull by which all who scoff at us are excommunicated. When the cardinal realized that there was no making an end, he sent away the hanger-on by a motion of his head and tactfully turned the conversation to another subject. Soon afterwards he rose from the table and, going to hear the petitions of his suitors, dismissed us. Look, my dear Moore, with how lengthy a tale I have burdened you. I should have been quite ashamed to protract it if you had not eagerly called for it and seemed to listen as if you did not want any part of the conversation to be left out. Though I ought to have related this conversation more concisely still, I felt bound to tell it, to exhibit the attitude of those who had rejected what I had said first, yet who immediately afterward, when the cardinal did not disapprove of it, also gave their approval, flattering him so much that they even smiled on and almost allowed in earnest the fancies of the hanger-on, which his master in jest did not reject. From this reaction you may judge what little regard courtiers would pay to me and my advice. To be sure, my dear Raphael, I commented, you have given me great pleasure, for everything you have said has been both wise and witty. Besides, while listening to you, I felt not only as if I were at home again in my native land, but as if I were become a boy again, by being pleasantly reminded of the very cardinal in whose court I was brought up as a lad. Since you are strongly devoted to his memory, you cannot believe how much more attached I feel to you on that account, attached exceedingly as I have been to you already. Even now, nevertheless, I cannot change my mind, but must needs think that if you could persuade yourself not to shun the courts of kings, you could do the greatest good to the common weal by your advice. The latter is the most important part of your duty, as it is the duty of every good man. Your favourite author, Plato, is of opinion that commonwealths will finally be happy only if either philosophers become kings or kings turn to philosophy. What a distant prospect of happiness there will be if philosophers will not condescend even to impart their counsel to kings. They are not so ungracious, he rejoined, that they would not gladly do it. In fact, many have already done it in published books, if the rulers would be ready to take good advice, but doubtless Plato was right in foreseeing that if kings themselves did not turn to philosophy, they would never approve of the advice of real philosophers, because they have been, from their youth, saturated and infected with wrong ideas. This truth he found from his own experience with Dionysius. If I proposed beneficial measures to some king and tried to uproot from his soul the seeds of evil and corruption, do you not suppose that I should be forthwith banished or treated with ridicule? Come now, suppose I were at the court of the French king and sitting in his privy council. In a most secret meeting, a circle of his most astute counsellors, over which he personally presides, is setting its wits to work to consider by what crafty machinations he may keep his hold on Milan, and bring back into his power the Naples which has been eluding his grasp. Then overwhelm Venice and subjugate the whole of Italy. Next, bring under his sway Flanders, Brabant, and finally the whole of Burgundy. And other nations, too, whose territory he has already conceived the idea of usurping. At this meeting, one advises that a treaty should be made with the Venetians to last just as long as the king will find it convenient, that he should communicate his intentions to them, and that he should even deposit in their keeping part of the booty, which, when all has gone according to his mind, he may reclaim. Another recommends the hiring of German Landsknechte, and another the mollification of the Swiss with money, and another the propitiation of the offended majesty of the emperor with gold as an acceptable offering. Another thinks that a settlement should be made with the king of Aragon, and that, as a guarantee of peace, someone else's kingdom of Navarre should be ceded him. Another proposes that the Prince of Castile be caught by the prospect of a marriage alliance, and that some nobles of his court be drawn to the French side by a fixed pension. Meanwhile, the most perplexing question of all comes up. What is to be done with England? They agree that negotiations for peace should be undertaken, that an alliance, always weak at best, should be strengthened with the strongest bonds, and that the English should be called friends, but suspected as enemies. The Scots, therefore, must be posted in readiness, prepared for any opportunity to be let loose on the English if they make the slightest movement. Moreover, some exiled noble must be fostered secretly, for treaties prevent it being done openly, to maintain a claim to the throne, that by this handle France may keep in check a king in whom it has no confidence. In such a meeting, I say, when such efforts are being made, when so many distinguished persons are vying with each other in proposals of a warlike nature, what if an insignificant fellow like myself were to get up and advise going on another tack? Suppose I expressed the opinion that Italy should be left alone. Suppose I argued that we should stay at home because the single kingdom of France by itself was almost too large to be governed well by a single man, so that the king should not dream of adding other dominions under his sway. Suppose, then, I put before them the decisions made by the people called the Achorians, who live on the mainland to the south-southeast of the island of Utopia. Once upon a time they had gone to war to win for their king another kingdom, to which he claimed to be the rightful heir by virtue of an old tie by marriage. After they had secured it, they saw they would have no less trouble in keeping it than they had suffered in obtaining it. The seeds of rebellion from within, or of invasion from without, were always springing up in the people thus acquired. They realized they would have to fight constantly for them or against them, and to keep an army in continual readiness. In the meantime, they were being plundered. Their money was being taken out of the country. They were shedding their blood for the little glory of someone else. Peace was no more secure than before. Their morals at home were being corrupted by war. The lust for robbery was becoming second nature. Criminal recklessness was emboldened by killings in war, and the laws were held in contempt. All because the king, being distracted with the charge of two kingdoms, could not properly attend to either. At length, seeing that in no other way would there be any end to all this mischief, they took counsel together and most courteously offered their king his choice of retaining whichever of the two kingdoms he preferred. He could not keep both, because there were too many of them to be ruled by half a king, just as no one would care to engage even a muleteer whom he had to share with someone else. The worthy king was obliged to be content with his own realm and to turn over the new one to one of his friends, who was driven out soon afterwards. Furthermore, suppose I proved that all this warmongering, by which so many nations were kept in a turmoil on the French king's account, would, after draining his resources and destroying his people, at length by some mischance end in naught, and that therefore he had better look after his ancestral kingdom and make it as prosperous and flourishing as possible, love his subjects and be loved by them, live with them and rule them gently, and have no designs upon other kingdoms, since what he already possessed was more than enough for him. What reception from my listeners, my dear Moore, do you think that this speech of mine would find? To be sure, not a very favourable one, I granted. Well then, let us proceed, he continued. Picture the counsellors of some king or other debating with him and devising by what schemes they may heap up treasure for him. One advises crying up the value of money when he has to pay any, and crying down its value below the just rate when he has to receive any, with the double result that he may discharge a large debt with a small sum, and when only a small sum is due to him, may receive a large one. Another suggests a make-believe war, under pretext of which he would raise money and then, when he saw fit, make peace with solemn ceremonies to throw dust in his simple people's eyes because their loving monarch in compassion would fain avoid human bloodshed. Another counsellor reminds him of certain old and moth-eaten laws, annulled by long non-enforcement, which no one remembers being made, and therefore everyone has transgressed. The king should exact fines for their transgression, there being no richer source of profit, nor any more honourable than such as has an outward mask of justice. Another recommends that under heavy penalties he prohibit many things, and especially such as it is to the people's advantage not to allow. Afterwards, for money, he should give a dispensation to those with whose interests the prohibition has interfered. Thus, favour is won with the people, and a double profit is made, first by exacting fines from those whose greed of gain has entangled them in the snare, and second, by selling privileges to others. And to be sure, the higher the price, the better the king, since he hates to give any private citizen a privilege which is contrary to the public welfare, and will not do so except at a great price. Another persuades him that he must bind to himself the judges, who will in every case decide in favour of the king's side. In addition, he must summon them to the palace and invite them to debate his affairs in his presence. There will be no cause of his so patently unjust in which one of them will not, either from a desire to contradict or from shame at repeating another's view, or to curry favour, find some loophole whereby the law can be perverted. When, through the opposite opinions of the judges, a thing in itself as clear as daylight has been made a subject of debate, and when truth has become a matter of doubt, the king is opportunely furnished a handle to interpret the law in his own interest. Everyone else will acquiesce, from shame or from fear. Afterwards, the decision is boldly pronounced from the bench. Then, too, a pretext can never be wanting for deciding on the king's side. For such a judge, it is enough that either equity be on his side, or the letter of the law, or the twisted meaning of the written word, or what finally outweighs all law with conscientious judges, the indisputable royal prerogative. All the councillors agree and consent to the famous statement of Crassus: no amount of gold is enough for the ruler who has to keep an army. Further, the king, however much he wishes, can do no wrong. For all that all men possess is his, as they themselves are, and so much is a man's own as the king's kindness has not taken away from him. It is much to the king's interest that the latter be as little as possible, seeing that his safeguard lies in the fact that the people do not grow insolent with wealth and freedom. These things make them less patient to endure harsh and unjust commands, while, on the other hand, poverty and need blunt their spirits, make them patient, and take away from the oppressed the lofty spirit of rebellion. At this point, suppose I were again to rise and maintain that these counsels are both dishonourable and dangerous for the king, whose very safety, not merely his honour, rests on the people's resources rather than his own. Suppose I should show that they choose a king for their own sake and not for his? To be plain, that by his labour and effort they may live well and safe from injustice and wrong? For this very reason, it belongs to the king to take more care for the welfare of his people than for his own, just as it is the duty of a shepherd, in so far as he is a shepherd, to feed his sheep rather than himself. The blunt facts reveal that they are completely wrong in thinking that the poverty of the people is the safeguard of peace. Where will you find more quarrelling than among beggars? Who is more eager for revolution than he who is discontented with his present state of life? Who is more reckless in the endeavour to upset everything, in the hope of getting profit from some source or other, than he who has nothing to lose? Now, if there were any king who was either so despicable or so hateful to his subjects that he could not keep them in subjection otherwise than by ill usage, plundering and confiscation, and by reducing them to beggary, it would surely be better for him to resign his throne than to keep it by such means. Means by which, though he retain the name of authority, he loses its majesty. It is not consistent with the dignity of a king to exercise authority over beggars, but over prosperous and happy subjects. That was certainly the sentiment of that noble and lofty spirit Fabricius, who replied that he would rather be a ruler of rich people than be rich himself. To be sure, to have a single person enjoy a life of pleasure and self-indulgence amid the groans and lamentations of all around him is to be the keeper, not of a kingdom, but of a jail. In fine, as he is an incompetent physician who cannot cure one disease except by creating another, so he who cannot reform the lives of citizens in any other way than by depriving them of the good things of life must admit that he does not know how to rule free men. Yea, the king had better amend his own indolence or arrogance, for these two vices generally cause his people either to despise him or to hate him. Let him live harmlessly on what is his own. Let him adjust his expenses to his revenues. Let him check mischief and crime, and by training his subjects rightly, let him prevent rather than allow the spread of activities which he will have to punish afterwards. Let him not be hasty in enforcing laws fallen into disuse, especially those which, long given up, have never been missed. Let him never take in compensation for violation anything that a private person would be forbidden in court to appropriate for the reason that such would be an act of crooked craftiness. What if, then, I were to put before them the law of the Macarians, a people not very far distant from Utopia? Their king, on the day he first enters into office, is bound by an oath at solemn sacrifices that he will never have at one time in his coffer more than 1,000 pounds of gold or its equivalent in silver. They report that this law was instituted by a very good king who cared more for his country's interest than his own wealth, to be a barrier against hoarding so much money as would cause a lack of it among his people. He saw that this treasure would be sufficient for the king to put down rebellion and for his kingdom to meet hostile invasions. It was not large enough, however, to tempt him to encroach on the possessions of others. The prevention of the latter was the primary purpose of his legislation. His secondary consideration was that provision was thus made to forestall any shortage of the money needed in the daily business transactions of the citizens. He felt, too, that since the king had to pay out whatever came into his treasury beyond the limit prescribed by law, he would not seek occasion to commit an injustice. Such a king will be both a terror to the evil and beloved by the good. To sum it all up, if I tried to obtrude these and like ideas on men strongly inclined to the opposite way of thinking, to what deaf ears should I tell the tale? Deaf indeed, without doubt, I agreed. And by heaven, I am not surprised. Neither, to tell the truth, do I think that such ideas should be thrust on people, or such advice given, as you are positive will never be listened to. What good could such novel ideas do, or how could they enter the minds of individuals who are already taken up and possessed by the opposite conviction? In the private conversation of close friends, this academic philosophy is not without its charm, but in the councils of kings, where great matters are debated with great authority, there is no room for these notions. That is just what I meant, he rejoined, by saying there is no room for philosophy with rulers. Right, I declared, that is true. Not for this academic philosophy, which thinks that everything is suitable to every place, but there is another philosophy, more practical for statesmen, which knows its stage, adapts itself to the play in hand, and performs its role neatly and appropriately. This is the philosophy which you must employ. Otherwise, we have the situation in which a comedy of Plautus is being performed, and the household slaves are making trivial jokes at one another, and then you come on the stage in a philosopher's attire and recite the passage from the Octavia where Seneca is disputing with Nero. Would it not have been preferable to take a part without words than by reciting something inappropriate to make a hodgepodge of comedy and tragedy? You would have spoiled and upset the actual play by bringing in irrelevant matter, even if your contribution would have been superior in itself. Whatever play is being performed, perform it as best you can, and do not upset it all simply because you think of another which has more interest. So it is in the Commonwealth. So it is in the deliberation of monarchs. You cannot pluck up wrong-headed opinions by the root. If you can cure, according to your heart's desires, vices of long standing, yet you must not on that account desert the Commonwealth. You must not abandon the ship in a storm because you cannot control the winds. On the other hand, you must not force upon people new and strange ideas which you realize will carry no weight with persons of opposite conviction. On the contrary, by the indirect approach you must seek and strive to the best of your power to handle matters tactfully. What you cannot turn to good, you must at least make as little bad as you can. For it is impossible that all should be well unless all men were good, a situation which I do not expect for a great many years to come. By this approach, he commented, I should accomplish nothing else than to share the madness of others as I tried to cure their lunacy. If I would stick to the truth, I must needs speak in the manner I have described. To speak falsehoods, for all I know, may be the part of a philosopher, but it is certainly not for me. Although that speech of mine might perhaps be unwelcome and disagreeable to those counsellors, yet I cannot see why it should seem odd, even to the point of folly. What if I told them the kind of things which Plato creates in his Republic, or which the Utopians actually put in practice in theirs? Though such institutions were superior, as to be sure they are, yet they might appear odd, because here individuals have the right of private property, there all things are common. To persons who had made up their minds to go headlong by the opposite road, the man who beckons them back and points out dangers ahead can hardly be welcome. But apart from this aspect, what did my speech contain that would not be appropriate or obligatory to have propounded everywhere? Truly, if all the things which by the perverse morals of men have come to seem odd are to be dropped as unusual and absurd, we must dissemble among Christians almost all the doctrines of Christ. Yet he forbade us to dissemble them to the extent that what he had whispered in the ears of his disciples he commanded to be preached openly from the housetops. The greater part of his teaching is far more different from the morals of mankind than was my discourse. But preachers, crafty men that they are, finding that men grievously disliked to have their morals adjusted to the rule of Christ, and following, I suppose, your advice, accommodated his teaching to men's morals as if it were a rule of soft lead, that at least in some way or other the two might be made to correspond. By this method, I cannot see what they have gained except that men may be bad in greater comfort. And certainly I should make as little progress in the councils of princes, for I should hold either a different opinion, which would amount to having none at all, or else the same, and then I should say, as Mitio says in Terence, help their madness. As to that indirect approach of yours, I cannot see its relevancy. I mean, your advice to use my endeavours, if all things cannot be made good, at least to handle them tactfully, and as far as one may, to make them as little bad as possible. At court there is no room for dissembling, nor may one shut one's eyes to things. One must openly approve the worst counsels, and subscribe to the most ruinous decrees. He would be counted a spy and almost a traitor, who gives only faint praise to evil counsels. Moreover, there is no chance for you to do any good, because you are brought among colleagues who would easily corrupt even the best of men before being reformed themselves. By their evil companionship, either you will be seduced yourself, or keeping your own integrity and innocence, you will be made a screen for the wickedness and folly of others. Thus you are far from being able to make anything better by that indirect approach of yours. For this reason, Plato, by a very fine comparison, shows why philosophers are right in abstaining from administration of the Commonwealth. They observe the people rushing out into the streets and being soaked by constant showers, and cannot induce them to go indoors and escape the rain. They know that if they go out, they can do no good, but will only get wet with the rest. Therefore, being content, if they themselves at least are safe, they keep at home, since they cannot remedy the folly of others. Yet surely, my dear Moore, to tell you candidly my heart's sentiments, it appears to me that wherever you have private property, and all men measure all things by cash values, there it is scarcely possible for a commonwealth to have justice or prosperity, unless you think justice exists where all the best things flow into the hands of the worst citizens, or prosperity prevails where all is divided among very few, and even they are not altogether well off, while the rest are downright wretched. As a result, when in my heart I ponder on the extremely wise and holy institutions of the Utopians, among whom, with very few laws, affairs are ordered so aptly that virtue has its reward, and yet, with equality of distribution, all men have abundance of all things, and then, when I contrast with their policies, the many nations elsewhere, ever making ordinances, and yet never one of them achieving good order, nations where whatever a man has acquired, he calls his own private property. But where all these laws, daily framed, are not enough for a man to secure or to defend, or even to distinguish from someone else's the goods which each in turn calls his own, a predicament readily attested by the numberless and ever new and interminable lawsuits, when I consider, I repeat, all these facts, I become more partial to Plato, and less surprised at his refusal to make laws for those who rejected that legislation which gave to all an equal share in all goods. This wise sage, to be sure, easily foresaw that the one and only road to the general welfare lies in the maintenance of equality in all respects. I have my doubts that the latter could ever be preserved where the individual's possessions are his private property. When every man aims at absolute ownership of all the property he can get, be there never so great abundance of goods, it is all shared by a handful who leave the rest in poverty. It generally happens that the one class preeminently deserves the lot of the other, for the rich are greedy, unscrupulous and useless, while the poor are well-behaved, simple, and by their daily industry more beneficial to the commonwealth than to themselves. I am fully persuaded that no just and even distribution of goods can be made, and that no happiness can be found in human affairs, unless private property is utterly abolished. While it lasts, there will always remain a heavy and inescapable burden of poverty and misfortunes, for by far the greatest and by far the best part of mankind. I admit that this burden can be lightened to some extent, but I contend that it cannot be removed entirely. A statute might be made that no person should hold more than a certain amount of land, and that no person should have a monetary income beyond that permitted by law. Special legislation might be passed to prevent the monarch from being overmighty and the people overweening. Likewise, that public officers should not be solicited with gifts, nor be put up for sale, nor require lavish personal expenditures. Otherwise, there arise, first, the temptation to recoup one's expenses by acts of fraud and plunder, and secondly, the necessity of appointing rich men to offices which ought rather to have been administered by wise men. By this type of legislation, I maintain, as sick bodies which are past cure can be kept up by repeated medical treatments, so these evils too can be alleviated and made less acute. There is no hope, however, of a cure and a return to a healthy condition, as long as each individual is master of his own property. Nay, while you are intent upon the cure of one part, you make worse the malady of the other parts. Thus the healing of the one member reciprocally breeds the disease of the other, as long as nothing can be added to one as not to be taken away from another. But, I ventured, I am of the contrary opinion. Life cannot be satisfactory where all things are common. How can there be a sufficient supply of goods when each withdraws himself from the labour of production? For the individual does not have the motive of personal gain, and he is rendered slothful by trusting to the industry of others. Moreover, when people are goaded by want, and yet the individual cannot legally keep as his own what he has gained, must there not be trouble from continual bloodshed and riot? This holds true especially since the authority of magistrates and respect for their office have been eliminated, for how can there be any place for these among men who are all on the same level, I cannot even conceive. I do not wonder, he rejoined, that it looks this way to you, being a person who has no picture at all, or else a false one of the situation I mean. But you should have been with me in Utopia, and personally seen their manners and customs as I did, for I lived there more than 5 years, and would never have wished to leave except to make known that new world. In that case, you unabashedly would admit that you had never seen a well-ordered people anywhere but there. Yet surely, objected Peter Giles, it would be hard for you to convince me that a better ordered people is to be found in that new world than in the one known to us. In the latter, I imagine, there are equally excellent minds as well as commonwealths which are older than those in the new world. In these commonwealths, long experience has come upon very many advantages for human life, not to mention also the chance discoveries made among us which no human mind could have devised. As for the antiquity of commonwealths, he countered, you could give a sounder opinion if you had read the historical accounts of that world. If we must believe them, there were cities among them before there were men among us. Furthermore, whatever either brains have invented or chance has discovered hitherto could have happened equally in both places. But I hold for certain that even though we may surpass them in brains, we are far inferior to them in application and industry. According to their chronicles, up to the time of our landing, they had never heard anything about our activities. They call us the ultra-equinoctials, except that 1,200 years ago a ship driven by a tempest was wrecked on the island of Utopia. Some Romans and Egyptians were cast on shore and remained on the island without ever leaving it. Now mark what good advantage their industry took of this one opportunity. The Roman Empire possessed no art capable of any use which they did not either learn from the shipwrecked strangers or discover for themselves after receiving the hints for investigation. So great a gain was it to them that on a single occasion some persons were carried to their shores from ours. But if any like fortune has ever driven anyone from their shores to ours, the event is as completely forgotten as future generations will perhaps forget that I had once been there, and just as they immediately at one meeting appropriated to themselves every good discovery of ours, so I suppose it will be long before we adopt anything that is better arranged with them than with us. This trait, I judge, is the chief reason why, though we are inferior to them, neither in brains nor in resources, their commonwealth is more wisely governed and more happily flourishing than ours. If so, my dear Raphael, said I beg and beseech you, give us a description of the island. Do not be brief, but set forth in order the terrain, the rivers, the cities, the inhabitants, the traditions, the customs, the laws, and in fact everything which you think we should like to know. And you must think we wish to know everything of which we are still ignorant. There is nothing, he declared, I shall be more pleased to do, for I have the facts ready to hand, but the description will take time. In that case, I suggested, let us go in to dine. Afterwards we shall take up as much time as we like. Agreed, he replied. So we went in and dined. We then returned to the same place, sat down on the same bench, and gave orders to the servants that we should not be interrupted. Peter Giles and I urged Raphael to fulfil his promise. As for him, when he saw us intent and eager to listen, after sitting in silent thought for a time, he began his tale as follows. The end of Book 1, Book 2 follows.